Vriende, baie welkom by hierdie week se episode van Wêreldwys hier op Marula Media. Ons het baie interessante onderhoud wat ons hierdie week voer met Joel Pollack. Hy was die afgelope tyd baie hier in Suid-Afrika in die nuus. Natuurlik redakteur by Breitbart News in Los Angeles in Amerika, 'n redelike konservatiewe nuuswebblad, 'n reuse media platform Breitbart. Maar Pollack ook bekend oor al sy uitsprake oor Suid-Afrika. Hy het lank hier gewoon. Hy ken en verstaan Suid-Afrika baie goed. Okay, welcome to this episode, Joel Pollack, all the way from Los Angeles in California. We are very delighted for you to be part of this program.
It's good to be with you.
Joel, like I've said in the intro also, you're one of the really, I think, important thinkers at the moment in this whole diplomatic crisis between South Africa and America. I want to ask you the first question, maybe just to elaborate on your own thinking, you know, of where this came from. You know, there's so many different voices on the origin of this diplomatic crisis, and maybe a perception in South Africa that this diplomatic crisis is just something that was created in the last 2 or 3 months since Donald Trump became president. But there's a much longer history in the development of this challenges between South Africa and the U.S.
Well, among the many things that the former ambassador, Ebrahim Rasool, said, one of the correct things was that this began under President Joe Biden, when Democrats became frustrated with South Africa, particularly over the issue of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. There were Republicans also who were upset about the invasion, but Democrats were particularly upset about it because they had put Russia at the center of their foreign policy, which was in some ways an extension of their domestic policy. They blamed Russia for Trump's rise to office, even though that was based on a conspiracy theory, but never mind. The Democrats essentially told President Biden to review South Africa's role in AGOA, the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, because of South Africa's actions, which were perceived as supporting Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And under AGOA, countries that participate in the preferential trade agreement cannot oppose American interests in terms of national security on the world stage. So Democrats, including some Republicans as well, but Democrats and Republicans wrote to the president and said, we would like to see a change in the administration's approach to South Africa, because South Africa obviously has changed its approach to us. And so people began looking in a critical way at South Africa, and many of the critical positions that some had taken about South Africa and concerns that people had expressed about the direction in which South Africa had been going over the years began to bubble to the fore. So concerns about corruption, concerns about the emphasis on race, other concerns, concerns about the treatment of workers, those began to be more loudly vocalized. And so you arrived at a point really where there was a bipartisan consensus that something was going wrong in South Africa. And then when President Trump returned to office for the second time, it became quite salient because of a variety of factors. Number one, the passage of the Expropriation Act in South Africa, which drew attention to the issue of the attempted racial redistribution of land. And South Africa in the interim had also taken a number of foreign policy positions in addition to supporting Russia. It had sided with China, conducted military exercises with China. It had also taken Israel to the International Court of Justice and accused it of genocide, which is really quite an extreme accusation. South Africa had earlier tried to avoid certain international judicial institutions when it came to the president of Sudan or Russian President Vladimir Putin, but suddenly decided that the international judicial institutions were important when it came to attacking Israel, even though Israel had been attacked completely unprovoked by a terrorist organization funded by Iran, armed by Iran, trained by Iran. So South Africa was taking positions in a very aggressive way, at least diplomatically, that were opposed to the interests of the United States and to the interests of American allies. And so Trump came into office looking at the world, looking at the map of the world and China's advance in particular around the world, and looked at countries in strategic positions, not just South Africa, but also Greenland, which is currently administered by Denmark, but Gaza as well. Trump said he wants to take control of Gaza. These are all places in strategic points in terms of world trade. They're on trade routes or near trade routes. And I believe that motivated Trump to respond more forcefully to South Africa's domestic policies, which also affect American investment and which affect U.S.-South African relations. So that's how we arrived at the current point. And then I think it was South African responses that really exacerbated it, because I don't think the political and media elite in South Africa are aware of how at odds with reality their worldview has become over the years. They've been isolated or insulated from criticism. They've dismissed domestic criticism as racist. They've dismissed foreign criticism. They don't get much of it because countries are often eager to be seen to be on the side of political correctness and on the side of a black majority government in South Africa. And these things do affect criticism. I don't think South Africans hear the honest views of observers around the world as they should. And I think some of these criticisms really want to help the South African government. They want to help the South African people. But because of a stifling kind of political correctness, you don't hear them. So, for example, in the current dispute, the United States has offered a number of criticisms of South African policies. And then the EU steps in and says, well, we'll give you billions of euros in investment. And there's no real discussion about what some of the problems might be in South Africa. And even though the EU has a lot of the same views that the United States does about what's going on in South Africa and what South Africa is doing on the world stage, these are not vocalized. Instead, European politicians sort of bask in the glow of the approval of President Cyril Ramaphosa and the government, and they go home and they tell their own constituents how wonderful they are for investing in this remote African country. And it feels good to them, but it doesn't actually correspond to what they truly believe about what South Africa is doing and the direction it should go. And I think with Trump, who doesn't really have a moment at all for political correctness, you're getting an unvarnished and direct view of how many people, not just Donald Trump, but how many people see what's happening in South Africa.
Absolutely so, you know, and then South Africa was also very much tone deaf in terms of the appointment of an ambassador, you know, when President Ramaphosa decided late last year to appoint Ebrahim Rasool as the South African ambassador to the US. And his record was well known, you know, the fact that he had close links with groups like Hamas in the Gaza Strip and places like that. And he's been outspoken against Israel, but also against America and against the West. And he arrived in Washington just the days before President Trump's inauguration. And then he made that unbelievable little presentation at the conference, the Mapungubwe Institute conference, you know, so that even worsened the situation. What is your take on that?
Well, again, it shows that South Africa is trapped in its own paradigm. Rasool is seen as a moderate within the ANC. So to President Ramaphosa, I can't put myself in his brain, but I think he imagined that that Rasool would be seen as more moderate than some of the extreme voices in South Africa, not just within the ANC, but in some of the new opposition parties. And he had the job before. He had it under Obama. So the thought was that the Democratic Party would be ascendant. They really, I think, took a gamble on Kamala Harris winning the election and Donald Trump losing. And had she won, perhaps Rasool would have been a very good choice, because her policies would also have been anti-Israel. Her policies would have been appeasement of Iran and China. They would have continued to follow the direction in which Joe Biden's policies had begun, and perhaps even more so moving to the left. So had Kamala Harris won, South Africans might have said, what a brilliant, inspired choice it was to send Ebrahim Rasool, because he's a moderate within the ANC, and all of these connections and all of these policy positions he's taken over the years are actually to our benefit. We can help guide a left-wing American administration to move closer to our policy preferences. But that was a gamble that failed. It was a bet that failed, and it failed to read the American political situation. Kamala Harris was not a very good presidential candidate. Donald Trump was much more popular than many observers gave him credit for, and he won. And Rasool continued to believe that he could represent South Africa. And personally, I didn't feel one way or the other about it, but he did come with some baggage. And that meant that he had some opposition within Washington, and he struggled to gain an audience. He also stuck to this paradigm that is common in South Africa, that Donald Trump is somehow illegitimate, that he represents racism, that he represents nativism. These are terms that Rasool used. It's not so extraordinary that he said that. That's what people say in South Africa. That's what people say on the left in the United States. That's the dominant discourse. You know, twice now, the American media, which leans left, has failed to understand why Trump won. And unfortunately, I think many people overseas, not just in South Africa, draw their cues about the United States from our mainstream media. You know, outlets like Marula Media and like Breitbart, where I work, provide, I think, a more accurate portrayal of what's going on. We have to be factually accurate because smaller outlets are often held to a higher factual standard than the mainstream ones, which have a sort of institutional legacy that means they can get away with printing complete lies for a long time. And they're not excluded from social media. They don't find themselves dismissed. So in a sense, smaller publications are held to a higher standard, but also because we have an audience that trusts us. And the mainstream media, things like the New York Times, CNN, they're seen as outlets that establish an historical record, but they don't have the same relationship with their audience. And so they're not held accountable for their mistakes or for their worldview when it turns out to be incorrect. I mean, the New York Times now is publishing articles saying, you know, perhaps the coronavirus escaped from a laboratory in China. The New York Times described that view in 2020 as dangerous, and they tried to end people's careers merely for suggesting that. They went after Senator Tom Cotton, who's a friend of mine, because he was one of the champions of this theory, the lab leak theory. And they said it was irresponsible, it was racist, it was all kinds of things. There's no apology from the New York Times for doing any of that, for telling the American public the wrong story and for telling them that people who believed the right story were horrible people. So anyway, I think that many in the South African elite and Europe and elsewhere do derive their opinions about American politics from our own media who don't understand it. I mean, I've often criticized CNN for failing to take its responsibility as a global brand seriously, because often it's the only network that's available from the United States in other countries. And what they see on CNN, which is a very left-wing and sometimes bitter portrayal of the Trump administration, that forms their views. So I can't, again, I can't put myself in the minds of South African policymakers, but it does seem to me when I read the South African media that South African elites do not understand the rise of Donald Trump except as a kind of white racist backlash, which again is how some commentators describe it in the New York Times and on CNN. But the reality is that Trump received more votes from Black and Hispanic Americans than any Republican president had before, and he actually won among Hispanic men. And why? The reason is that he represented a rejection of elite establishment politics, of a dysfunctional economy, and of a foreign policy that failed to put the national interest first. And Americans have rejected race as the criterion for life. There are some who cling to it, but what you see right now across industry, across universities, is a thorough rejection of the idea that race is the most important factor in the advancement of an individual or in the policies that these institutions and corporations take. And so there was always a constituency for reform. Donald Trump represents that. He represents Americans wanting to return to values of freedom, of hard work, and of fairness. And those are quite ordinary aspirations, but they've been stifled for a long time by our political class, by our media. And Rasool didn't get that, because I think many observers don't get that. And so to describe the American administration as racist and nativist was offensive and counterproductive, and it destroyed a relationship that he had been trying to build with the new administration. But it's not unusual in the constellation of media voices and critics of this administration. I recently read a piece in the Daily Maverick, which said that if you compromise with Trump, he just takes more. And actually, that's a complete misreading of Donald Trump. In fact, some of his supporters are concerned that when people do compromise with Donald Trump, he gives away too much. So it's a complete misreading of the Trump administration. The way to deal with Donald Trump, and again, you can look at many, many examples, Canada, Mexico, many examples. When you compromise with him, even a little bit, he does reciprocate. He believes in this idea of reciprocity. He says it all the time. So he'll be very tough with you until you work with him, and then he's very nice to you. He'll praise you to the skies. I mean, look at North Korea. Donald Trump threatened to wipe out his regime in quote-unquote fire and fury. And the moment Kim Jong-un moved a few steps toward Trump, they were the best buddies. They got together in Singapore. They had a meeting. They had a summit. They signed some documents. They developed a relationship. So remember that Trump walked away from a deal in Vietnam with Kim Jong-un because Kim Jong-un would not compromise on the nuclear issue. So Trump doesn't give away the store if you compromise with him. But the writers of the Daily Maverick, I think, misread Trump because many people misread Trump. If your filter is the left-wing media or even our mainstream media, chances are you will not understand Trump. And I've had to explain Trump to people who might otherwise be inclined to support him because the perception of him that's created by our mainstream networks, which I do think are the networks that reach more broadly across the globe, is incorrect. And I think South Africa, in a way, is trapped in its own misconceptions that it then reinforces. So if you believe, as Rasool believes, that Trump is the center of a global white supremacist conspiracy, then you won't compromise. Why would you compromise with a racist? And as a result, the American administration perceives South Africa's attitude as hostile, and so it reacts to that, and then you have a downward spiral. Instead, you need to perhaps question the paradigm, question your assumptions, and if you're the South African government anyway, and you need to say, okay, what are we not understanding about Trump? Maybe we should listen to some different voices who could explain his worldview to us a little more accurately. Maybe we could try a different approach and see if it works.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to talk about that approach, you know, because I think that's, you're absolutely correct. When I talk to South African journalists at the mainstream media in South Africa, they all read the New York Times and they all watch CNN, you know, and their view on the Trump administration are very well formed on that, you know. But in my own travels to America, when I go to Hispanic communities and African American communities, I hear how people agree with the Trump worldview, you know, and that's fascinating, you know, every time that I visited America in the last 12 or 18 months. What must South Africa now do? You know, that's the big question. There, we have a government of national unity. What must the push back be in terms of other parties within the government of national unity when they address this issue with the ANC and with President Ramaphosa? What must the strategy be to fix the relationship with the US?
Well, just to emphasize something you said about how Trump is perceived. He is perceived as strong, fundamentally. So that makes his opponents upset, sometimes afraid, but it makes his supporters very happy. So if you talk to his supporters, as you mentioned, in the Hispanic community, they see him as a strong leader who is sorting out problems. And it's different from the Republican leaders they're used to, who they perceived either as indifferent to what they care about or as openly hostile, perhaps racist, in some of their immigration positions. And what Trump does is he says, look, I support legal immigration, but I oppose further illegal immigration. And it turns out that position is actually supported by a broad swath of the Hispanic community who were previously sort of patronized by the Democratic Party and the media elite as somehow wanting unlimited illegal immigration. And Trump goes straight to the economic priorities of that community, which involve economic growth and job opportunities. And Trump says, no, I'm going to make sure people work. I'm going to make sure people have opportunities. So it's that strength that people react to. Now, it doesn't mean everybody likes him. Some people, again, dislike his strong approach. But often when people have strong opinions about someone, even if they're a negative opinion, it doesn't mean that they dislike the person or won't work with the person. Sometimes if you have a very strong opinion, you can still compromise with that person. So the strategy I would suggest South Africa should adopt is to offer compromises on policy and understand what Trump is asking. And I think those ideas are out there. So I think South Africa should come back to the table with compromises on specific policy issues, on the Expropriation Act, on BEE for foreign companies, on the relationship with China and Iran, on the attitude toward Israel and the Palestinians. I think South Africa needs to come to the table with compromises and show that it is willing to be more productive and not merely to pursue a path of confrontation.
Yes, absolutely. And do you think that it's necessary now to make a new appointment for a South African ambassador to the US? Is that something that is urgent, or must they wait some time? And what kind of ambassador will you appoint to the US now after what happened with Rasool?
I think the person is less important than the policy. So whoever South Africa appoints has to carry with him or her a set of compromises to open a discussion, not a set of assumptions and misconceptions, and a willingness to listen. But really, the policy is the most important thing. And I think that the South African government needs to decide that it's ready to change its own policies, and that will change the relationship. And I think Donald Trump will work with whoever South Africa sends. Race doesn't matter, political affiliation doesn't matter, age doesn't matter. The most important thing that matters is an ability to deliver on policy compromises that the United States wishes to see. The other thing, I think, and this is quite apart from the ambassadorial choice, is that South Africa needs to ask itself what it wants from the United States. I hear a lot of talk about what the United States might do and what happens to AGOA, what happens to PEPFAR, what happens to various things that the American administration does. We don't hear much about what South Africa wants from the United States. Has South Africa defined what it seeks out of the relationship? Does it just seek to receive aid? Does it just seek to receive preferential trade? What does it want the United States to do? Because when you enter a negotiation, you offer compromises, you know what you're willing to give, but you also have some leverage to ask for things. Now, South Africa has lost a lot of its leverage, but still, what would South Africa like the Trump administration to do? I don't think much thought has gone into that. I haven't heard anything. And in fact, when I've spoken to people in South Africa and said, well, what would you want? Some have answers, but very few, and most have not. And they just think about this as a kind of great power game that plays out across social media and editorial pages. But they haven't actually thought about what South Africa's national interest is. So what is it? And I think if you appoint someone who understands what South Africa's interests are and what South Africa must do, must compromise to restart the conversation, then I think whoever the ambassador is will be very successful.
Yes, absolutely. So now I think we're in a changing world, you know, in terms of the global power relations. And I think the Trump administration is actually accelerating this reorganization of global relations. And South Africa stands somewhere in the middle of that. There's lots of risks involved in that. But I always tell people there's also great opportunities involved in that. Countries who are willing to work with the U.S. can make great or can really unlock those opportunities. If you look at what a country like some of the Central American and Southern American countries are doing at the moment in terms of their relationship with America. How do you see this whole power struggle, this global power relations playing out in the next year or two?
Well, we're really talking about more than a year or two. I mean, we're talking about the next 5 to 10 years. And China is moving very aggressively to become a dominant world power if it can. It wants to dominate trade routes. It wants to dominate production. It wants to dominate shipping. And it has several disadvantages, not the least of which is that the United States has a head start of half a century. But it also has some advantages, which are that the United States has domestic challenges that prevent it from acting as swiftly as China does. We have a democracy that is rambunctious and sometimes dysfunctional that makes us more robust and stronger in the long run. But as democracies often do, it causes us sometimes to falter at the outset of a confrontation. You know, in the 1930s and 1940s, when the democracies of the world were confronted with the challenge of fascism on the one hand and communism on the other, fascism and communism moved much more quickly in the beginning, because the leaders were able to mobilize their societies much more easily. Democracy outlasted those systems in the end because those systems do not adapt well to change. And I think the same is true of the Chinese system. It doesn't adapt well to change. Democracy does, but we've got to start the change. We've got to start looking at the future in a realistic way. Here in California, where I sit, we have a left-wing government that has some of the same problems that the South African government does. It has been for many years a one-party state. it has been a state government here that ignores the opposition. So you have a democratic power structure that ignores the Republican opposition, and that has led to policy mistakes. So as the fifth largest economy in the world, we really don't have an excuse for underperforming, and there have to be some changes, whether that means Republicans win some state offices or not. There has to be a very new approach from our state government. Otherwise, we're going to continue to tumble into the abyss because, again, wealth is not the only thing that matters. It doesn't actually solve a society's problems. We have all kinds of other issues that we have to deal with, from disaster prevention to crime to homelessness, all kinds of things. And we're not dealing with them right now. China deals with these problems in a very draconian and cruel way. And there are some in the world who admire the Chinese way and would like to emulate it. At least they say they would. They perhaps wouldn't like to be the recipients of it, but they say that the state in China is very, very strong and the government does whatever it wants, and we should adopt that approach. And it really is a contest between two ideas. Does a highly ordered technocratic society led by a supposedly all-knowing elite provide the best model for humanity, or does the democratic process of individuals governing themselves, governing each other, rambunctious and loud and difficult though it may be, does that really offer the best way forward? Does an emphasis on individual liberty offer the best outcomes? That's still the contest in the world today. And I think that it's going to play out over the next 5, 10, perhaps 20 years, but it requires the democracies of the world to think differently about their national interest. Right now, the idea that's dominant in global policy discourses is that there are a set of principles that is transcendent, and these principles have to take precedence over everything else, including the national interest. And there's been a backlash against that because these countries have human beings living in them, and those human beings have legitimate needs. And the abstract principles of the global system sometimes have deep costs for these people, and sometimes the elites that have benefited from the existing set of principles are insensitive to the fact that they are tied to communities, they're tied to nations, they exist because of the nations that enrich them and send them to nice conferences and things like that. And so there has to be a kind of realignment of the world's leaders with the needs of the people whom they represent. That's what Donald Trump represents. He's not an autocrat. He doesn't represent a kind of mirror image of China or Russia. He is actually, in many ways, a liberal constitutional Democrat with a small lowercase d. But he also represents a nation and a group of people who have suffered for these abstract principles for quite some time and are saying, we're not prepared to take it anymore. And actually, it doesn't even work the way you want to do things. Giving up our national interest doesn't lead to better outcomes. We allowed China, for example, into all these global trade institutions. And instead of playing by the rules, China simply began taking over. So we have to assert our interest. Otherwise, this lovely set of international principles that we have is going to be swiftly ended by a totalitarian regime that doesn't care about them. And I think that the democracies of the world have to think very carefully about how to balance the principles that we cherish with the people who we are. And there is a balance. There's a way to do it. And Donald Trump is doing it. But he, I think, initially was rejected by some of the very people who he was helping and who couldn't see that he was helping them. And it's often interesting to see the opinion elites of our country completely bewildered by the fact that Trump is doing exactly what they wanted someone to do, but couldn't find out how to do it. And that, I think, points us in the direction of where things need to go. We do need strong leadership, not totalitarian leadership, not leadership that stifles freedom and so forth, but we need strong and decisive leadership that is prepared to face the reality of what it takes to organize our societies in a productive and stable manner to meet the challenge of China and other rival powers.
Thank you. That's just a last question from my side, Joel. You're at Breitbart News, institution that becomes more and more influential when the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, tweeted out about the South African ambassador, or he also linked to an article that you wrote. Alternative and new media are playing a more and more important role in the world, also in South Africa, but especially in the US. How do you see that in future, the change of the media landscape and the role that this changing media landscape will play in all this changing power structures, also especially in democratic countries?
Well, the rise of the alternative media is great for adding to the diversity of voices, to correcting some of the mistaken impressions and, frankly, untrue things that are said in mainstream publications because of the agendas of the people driving those publications. You know, the closer that these media publications become to centers of power, the more they are players in a political game. And it's better to be upfront about that rather than to hide it behind a veil of objectivity. But I think what this requires is that individuals become better consumers of media. When we have more choices, we have to be careful and use those choices to our advantage. So I do think that the variety of choices that is now becoming available does benefit the individual media consumer. By the way, individuals are also producers of media. With our smartphones, it's possible to become citizen journalists. We all become potential witnesses to important news events that we can record and share to the world. And we have to become, I think, more robust about the sources of information that we choose, about the kinds of facts that we take in. We have to adopt, I think, a healthy skepticism, even toward media outlets whose worldview we share. So I think it does require us as individuals to develop a stronger sense of responsibility for our own opinions and a sense of healthy skepticism, I think, toward where they come from. We can be more intelligent and wiser consumers of media, as well as producers of media, in a media landscape that's more diverse.
Yes, that I can fully agree with. Joel, thank you very much. Thank you for your time. And thank you for the important work that you're doing there in Los Angeles. And we hope to talk to you again in the future.
Thanks so much.